certainly glad to be here, and I did enjoy the song service, especially the things that were said on our behalf in the prayer. I appreciate that very much, and being here with everyone. I'd like to bring a lesson to you tonight that I hope very little of what I say tonight is going to hit home. But if it needs to, then I hope it hits you right between the eyes. We're going to talk about the consequences of sin. Now, we're going to talk about sin and the root of sin, but we're talking about the consequences of sin. Where does it lead to? What happens to it? What awful things do people undergo? How much pain and suffering do they allow themselves to go through? How much money of their income do they spend trying to live with the sins that they get into? These are things that we want to talk about tonight. Let's talk about a few definitions. From Mr. Webster, a definition of consequence, the consequence of sin. Consequence is a word that means that which follows from any act, cause, principle, or series of actions, an event or effect produced by some preceding act or cause. So we're going to be talking a lot tonight about a train of thought, the train of thought of where sin will lead us. I'm going to play around with this word just a little bit, so give me the liberty of playing around. Bill's definition as related to sin, consequence, is two words, con and sequence. Con is a word which means against. Sequence is a word which means a following or coming after, a succession, a particular order or arrangement of succession, an invariable order of succession, a series of things following in a certain order. Notice what I have highlighted, an invariable order of succession. I want to plant a seed in your mind, and I want you to be thinking about this during this lesson. Is a person going to commit a sin that he didn't think out in his mind first? I just kind of roll that over just a little bit, and we'll see if we can come to some conclusion when this is over with. But in this definition, we see this phrase, an invariable order of succession. And I propose to you that this invariable order starts with the thought of the mind. It proceeds to a determination of the will to commit something the mind has thought up in all cases. In all cases. So consequence of sin is a sequence which is against us. God's definition of the consequence is this, in Galatians 6, verses 7 and 8. Be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatsoever a man sows, that shall he also reap. For he that sows to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption, but he that sows to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. But notice the sequence there. A man sows, and then he reaps. Now, have you ever seen a person reap before he sows? No, there's got to be a sowing, there's got to be a planting, there's got to be a creation of life in some manner before the fruits of that life can be harvested. So God gives us this sequence, not in so many words, but He lays the sequence out. So let's look at God's definition of sin. We talked about what a consequence might be. What does the sin represent? 1 John 3 and 4 just plainly states, that whosoever commits sin transgresses also the law, for sin is the transgression of the law. Well, what's so bad about the transgression of the law? How many of you broke the law getting here tonight? You know, they put the speed limit on some of these secondary farm-to-market roads at 45 miles an hour. How many of you kept the speedometer needle below 45 on these secondary farm-to-market roads that you're like me, you grew up driving 55 and 60 on these roads? Broke the law. Did we sweat it? May have, may not. If you're really worried about it, there'd be a lot of people walking up the aisle making a confession tonight after this lesson's over with. If we really think that it was a bad thing, we broke the law. Didn't worry about it. When it comes to God's law? What's the big deal about breaking God's law? I mean, you don't see God on every street corner with a whistle around his neck and a police cap on, policing people. Well, he's going to do that at the end of time. What we're trying to do is to make sure we don't break it now. But what is the problem with transgressions. If you look at what God asked us to do, everything He asked us to do was something for our good. For our good. All the way back into the Old Testament when He talked about the kinds of flesh that was good to eat and the way we're supposed to conduct ourselves to be healthy. It was all for people's good. Now, if you transgress something that's good for you, it's going to be something bad for you. I want to plant this other seed in your mind and think about this. Sin, the biggest problem with sin is it is simply a distraction. It distracts us from our course. It occupies a certain amount of time while we're in it that we will not spend thinking about God's will. It will occupy a certain amount of our resources so that we are not as resourceful and as talented as we would have been. How long does it take you to learn how to sing? Shape notes. Well, if you really put your time to it, it doesn't really take long to learn how to sing shape notes. But how many of you have devoted the time to actually learning to sing shape notes? Now, I'm not trying to knock people that don't. I'm just using it for an example. Religion is involved with things that take time. There's skills that the Lord gave us that we develop to be good at religion. And I'm just using singing by shape notes for an example. But how many of you have taken the time to do it? Because we've been doing other things with that time. It's so easy to find other things to do. Sin is something that distracts us and fills up our time so that we don't do the things that at the end of our life we would say, you know, I wish I'd spent more time doing this so I could have been more accomplished at this or that. Or whatever. So sin is a distraction. Sin is like a business. It has wages and it has products. And you know where we're going on the first verse. The wages are rightfully earned. Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. The wages are death. Now, every business has wages. Every business has products. The wages of death. We'll get paid those at the end of our life if we so lived in sin. The products are the bitter fruits that we live with now. The bitter fruits. Just look at this example and look at the bitterness that was caused by this sin. And we're going to look at this sin several times. This is about David. This is what was happening to him as a result of his sin with Bathsheba. 2 Samuel 12:14-18. Howbeit, because by this deed you have given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, and the pronoun you there, that's King David himself. The child also that is born unto you shall surely die. And the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bare unto David, and it was very sick. David therefore besought God for the child, and David fasted and went in and lay all night upon the earth. And the elders of his house arose and went to him to raise him up from the earth, but he would not, neither did he eat bread with them. And it came to pass on the seventh day that the child died. The consequences of sin. We're going to talk about the details of this sin in just a moment, but right now we're looking at the consequences. How many things of grief? Now, I've highlighted a few that just jumped out at me. Just look, the child was very sick. Now we read down here that after 7 days, the child died. For 7 days, because of David's sin, the child was very sick. David fasted in his grief. He could not eat. He could not take nourishment as a consequence of his few moments of pleasure, of his sin. He fasted, too sick to eat for a week. He lay all night on the earth. Can you imagine the grief to lay on the ground? What was going through the man's mind as his little child lay there? What was going through his mind? What would go through your mind if something happened to a child that you loved very much and you knew that it was your fault? What would you be thinking? Can you not just feel the grief and the agony that he lived with for 7 days. The elders saw him. They tried to come and get him up. They were distressed. Here's our king. Get up. Let us comfort you. Let us console you. It had nothing to do with it. They were distressed. After 7 days, the child died. I just think, all of this happened as a consequence of sin. Now, you may say this is an extreme case. But see, what we're seeing here is a snapshot of all this grief squeezed into 7 days. What about people that commit a sin and they bear the results of that sin for a lifetime? They have caused grief and they endure it for a lifetime. And it's spread out over years unless they find something to deaden the pain of the grief of the things they caused. It's easy to see here because it's compressed into 7 days. There's a toxic waste beside a product. There's a toxic waste people live with. Shame and guilt. Romans 6:21. What fruit had you then in those things whereof you are now ashamed? For the end of those things is death. Do you remember the time before you walked up the aisle, just before you walked up the aisle to take the preacher's hand and to say that I want to make that confession that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and I want to start living for Christ? Do you know what you were thinking and feeling just before you came up that aisle? You were feeling guilt and you were feeling shame at the way you had lived your life and things that you had done, and you couldn't stand it any longer. And if you came up that aisle for any other reason, tell me what it would have been that was worth it. Surely you didn't walk up the aisle because you thought you were old enough and Mom and Daddy expected you to, or your friend had done it the night before. Surely you can remember that guilt and that shame that we couldn't stay back there in that bench any longer, but we had to fix things. We had to get things right. The only way to get it right was to come to the Lord and ask for forgiveness and to confess and be baptized for the remission of those sins. But even now, we might look back upon the things that we had done, and even though we know God said, I will forgive you if you repent, just the memory, the scarred memory of the things that we had done in our past, things we had left undone, that we should have done, time we should have spent doing good things we didn't, and we're ashamed. We're ashamed. I often think, and I'll go ahead and relay this to you because we may use this several times tonight or this week, I mentioned to you the other night about there was an R-rated movie that I had seen, Schindler's List. And this man was a person who was a businessman, and what he was trying to do was to save as many Jews as he could out of the concentration camps by employing them in a business. Don't know exactly what his motive was during the time he was trying to save these people, if he really realized it was life he was saving or if he was trying to make money. But for whatever reason, when the war was over with, and they were on a train, and he was on the train with the people that he had saved, and he had an expensive car. And when he got off the train and realized the war was over, and he saw all these people that he had actually saved their lives by using them in his factories, and he realized that he was dealing with lives. Well, he was trading diamonds and cash and everything else to get these people to live, to work in his factory so they wouldn't be killed in the gas chamber. But when he was all over with, he stood there on the train tracks looking at these people that he had saved their lives. And he broke down and he looked at this car that he had and he said, for this car, I could have saved 20 people. I could have saved 20 more people for what I spent on this car. And then what struck me was our time is our most valuable possession. And when it's all over with, and when we can't do anything else about it, what will strike us that we could have done for the time we spent doing this? What is it that's eaten up the most precious resource we have, which is our time? Time to study, time to improve ourselves, time to go see other people, time to do the Lord's work. But what do we spend our time doing? For this, I could have accomplished this and helped other people. Those things whereof you are now ashamed because of wasted opportunities. So let's follow the sequence of events. We're going to talk about five or six things. And what we want to look at now is the sequence of events. Adultery. Adultery started with an opportunity to look and to lust. Think of this. 2 Samuel 11, verses 1 through 5. All Israel, and if you see the little dots here, I've had to cut out words and phrases, but I'm trying to give you this story. All Israel besieged Rabbah, but David tarried still at Jerusalem. In an eventide night, David rose from off his bed, walked upon the roof of the king's house, and he saw a woman washing herself, and the woman was very beautiful to look upon. David sent and inquired about the woman. And one said, "Is not this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" And David sent messengers and took her, and she came in unto him, and he lay with her. And for she was purified from her uncleanness, she returned to her house. And the woman conceived and sent unto told David and said, "I am with child." Okay? Let's look at the story backwards. A woman became with child. Now, to us, that's a joyful thing. How many of you parents remember the joy when you first found out that you were going to have a child? Or your grandparents, when you first found out that you were going to be a grandparent. That was a joyous thing. That was a thing not to be ashamed. But why in this instance is it such a bad thing that actually led to the death of the child that we just have studied? This is the event that led up to that. Why? Well, let's just work backwards. She was with child. The woman conceived, and that's a natural thing for a woman to conceive if they do certain things. God made women that way to conceive. But what was the problem here? We back up a little bit, and a man lay with her. Well, naturally. But this particular instance, she was not his wife. But she came to him. Why did she come to him in the first place? Well, she came to him and she allowed him to take her. He took her, but he had already sent messages. This was no spontaneous, just a flame up of emotions that we can't control thing. This was a plotted thing. This was a planned thing. He sent people. But how did he know who to send for? Well, he was going to send for the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. He didn't just send for anybody. He sent for this woman. And it was pointed out to him before he sent for her that she was another man's wife. But he did it anyway. Why did he do that? Why did he inquire? Why did he send to inquire about her before he sent the messengers? Because the woman was very beautiful to look upon. The woman was very beautiful to look upon. Well, why was David allowed the opportunity to see this woman like this? Because she presented herself and he allowed the distraction. She presented herself because she was in a place where she would wash and someone on a higher rooftop could see her. She made a presentation. Can you imagine a decent woman going up to a place where they could be seen to bathe? You know, there's a term for people that like to do things like that. They call it exhibitionists. You reckon she was an exhibitionist? You reckon she just didn't think? She presented herself, but then David allowed himself the distraction. Now, I say a distraction because if you know the rest of this story, you know that Uriah came back from the battle, and Uriah was so in touch with his fellow soldiers that were fighting that he wouldn't allow himself to go in to his very own wife. He wouldn't allow himself to go into Bathsheba because he was concerned about his men that he was fighting with in the battle. David's the king. He's over all of these people. And he's not worried about them. He's up there gazing at a woman baby. Just doesn't add up, does it? Why wasn't he as concerned about these men he's sending out there in the battle? But he's not. He's up there being distracted. So you see what happened. The consequences of sin we read about. The consequences of sin was the child died. The king lay on the ground 7 days fasting and wouldn't get up. The elders could not get him up. He lived with that grief because he had taken this woman. And we're going to read in just a moment the other great awful thing that he did. Because he looked. He looked and he saw. The presentation was made and he took the bait. So what we see when we come to sin is oftentimes we see the presentation of the sin, but we see that somebody has got to take the bait. It's just like fishing. Satan is going to dangle the worms. He's going to dangle whatever that he thinks is our weakness, waiting on us to nibble, waiting on us to bite. And when he's got the trap sure and he knows we're there, he'll snap it. This is why we are to be wise people in the ways of the world, not be ignorant concerning sin. Adultery started with an opportunity to look in lust. Every consequence of sin had a beginning in each sinner's life. Matthew recorded what Jesus said in Matthew 5:27-28. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, you shall not commit adultery, but I say unto you. He's laying down a principle that goes beyond the act. That whosoever looks on a woman to lust after her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Whosoever looks on the woman. Now, in these days, I want to tell you guys, the bait's going to be presented. Because there's too much out there on the internet, on the news, on TV, anywhere you go, anywhere you look, unless you don't go anywhere or do anything, the bait is presented. If you do not control the thoughts of your mind, there's going to be things for you to lock on and for you to become infatuated with and to fall to this sin, this lust. It's out there. And you're not going to avoid it unless you're going to find a place somewhere to live, like in a monastery. I just don't think we're going to do that. So we've got to throttle down these passions and bring them under control like we're supposed to and not be guilty of this. Because I don't think it's going to be a good defense to stand before God and say, well, Lord, you made these women look so good. He's going to tell us, I also gave you control. My son died on the cross for you. Do you think that's so light that you can spend and be distracted by a strange flesh when I sent my son and he died for you? Is that equal? No. Fornication and incest, 2 Samuel 13:1-15. These are awful things, but there's so many things that are illustrated in these examples. This is sort of the beginning and the end of this story. Absalom had a fair sister, is one of David's sons. These are David's children. Absalom had a fair sister, Tamar. And Amnon loved her. Okay? And then you got three dots, and we jump to the end of the story. Something happened. And Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he had loved her. What turned a man's great love into great hate? Sin. That was a consequence of sin. A man's great love was turned into great hate. Now here's the rest of the story. There's several things that we need to pick up out of this nasty story. Absalom had a fair sister, Tamar. Amnon loved her. But Amnon had a friend, Jonadab, a very subtle man, who said, why are you, being the king's son, lean from day to day? Why are you kind of gaunt and despairing looking? Why are you lean from day to day? Amnon said unto him, I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. Okay, now right here is where a critical point in this story is fixing to break. If Jonadab was a person of God, he would have squelched this thing right there. He would have said, like you and I would have said, listen, you better straighten up because you cannot do this. You cannot think this. Don't even let these thoughts go through your head. But what did he do?
he tried to find a way for him to get her. He devised a plan. Look, we don't need friends like Jonadab, do we? Choose your company. Choose your company well. The Bible talks about, and we're going to talk about later, about what happens when you don't choose your company well and you fool around with bad communications. You listen to the wrong kind of people. There is a sin in choosing the wrong company. Jonadab was the wrong company. I'll tell you how this plays out in real life. Young man divorced, has a brother-in-law. And these two guys, they like to watch R-rated movies. And when I tell you this story, you're going to see why I told you the other night. That's holy ground to me. I don't like to see, and I know that I've heard Christians inside the church building talking about R-rated movies they've seen. And I can't stand it. You don't get mad at me and throw things at me if you want to. But that just irks me to hear Christians, so-called Christians, standing inside the church building talking about movies they've seen, and I knew the thing was R-rated. Okay. Young man gets divorced. Brother-in-law, by his age, they watch these R-rated movies. Brother-in-law brings a couple of movies, says, here, you watch these movies. There's no naked women in these movies. The young man divorced says, well, what do you want to watch it for then? Now, these are church guys. That's the attitude of folks who don't watch these R-rated movies. There's no naked women in it. Why do you want to watch it? Now, you see why that's holy ground to me? Because it poisons the mind. It poisons the mind. It feeds the cancer in the mind. The flame is there burning all the time. It doesn't need fanning and feeding and the fuel turned up to it by the things that are readily available for us to go see and watch. It doesn't need it. There's too many people today that act like Jonadab, and instead of helping people be straight, they're helping them to stay in the same lust they're in. Okay. Amnon said unto him, I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister. Jonadab said, here's what you do. Make yourself sick. So Amnon made himself sick. Acted like he was sick. King David came to see about it. And Amnon said, let Tamar, my sister, come. So David, thinking it was a good thing, didn't realize what he was sending his daughter to, sent her to him, to help him get better. See what a play was made and abused the trust that David had. But see, people in sin will do that. They will abuse the trust that other people have in them. That's what you do when you sin. Somewhere along the line, you're abusing. You know what the Bible says about fornication? In one spot, it says, defraud not your brother. Stay away from fornication. Because you're doing more than hurting the person you're committing fornication with. You're hurting the family. You're defrauding more than just that one person. The one act is not just one single solitary deed with no strings attached. But there's others that are hurt by this. Okay. So David was taken advantage of here by one of his children. Okay, David sent her. Tamar said, go now to thy brother Amnon's house, dress him meat. So Tamar went. He made cake, but he refused to eat. Then Amnon said, have all these men out from me. Get them out of my bedchamber. Bring the meat into the chamber that I may eat out of your hand. So she, thinking this was still an innocent thing, did it. He took hold of her and said, come lie with me, my sister. No, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought to be done in Israel. Do not you this folly, and I, where shall I cause my shame to go? Now, does this sound familiar? Was not David warned before he sent for Bathsheba that she was somebody else's wife? And like father, like son. Is she not making the plea right now? Don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do it to me and don't do it to you. But would he listen? No. Like father, like son. As for you, you shall be as one of the fools in Israel. But he would not hearken unto her voice, but being stronger than she, forced her, lay with her. Then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he loved her. And Amnon said, get out of here. I won't see you anymore. Rise and be gone. That's what sin does. It turns things around, doesn't it? It makes a good situation terrible. The normal love between a brother and a sister turned into an awful thing. And we know that later, after about a two-year period, Absalom got his revenge on Amnon and killed. Murder. We've been talking about different things. Talk about murder. I know nobody in here would be guilty of murder, but maybe it goes back to the beginning of a sin. Here's what happened when David got rid of Bathsheba's husband. David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. He wrote in the letter saying, set you, Uriah, in the forefront of the hottest battle and retire you from him that he may be smitten and die. When Joab observed the city that he assigned Uriah unto a place where he knew the valiant men were, the men of the city went out and fought with Joab, and there fell some of the people of the servants of David, and Uriah the Hittite died also. Okay, let's work backwards through this. What's the big deal? A soldier got killed. Uriah the Hittite. But then all these other people of the servants of David, they had names too. We just weren't given their names. But there was more people that died that day besides Uriah the Hittite. So what's the big deal about Uriah the Hittite? The big deal, Uriah the Hittite carried his own death warrant back to the battle out of his loyalty to the king who had betrayed him and slept with his wife. David betrayed that trust and sent the man's death warrant with him. The consequences of sin, the cover-up that we have to do. They put him in the battle. And no, David didn't fire the gun. David didn't pull the bow and shoot the arrow. David didn't swing the sword that killed him. But he did everything else. Had him set up. And let other people listen. He let even some of his other servants died when the valiant men pulled away. So to make sure Uriah died, some other people died too. But they were willing to be, David was willing to sacrifice himself. He was willing to sacrifice him. How many people through with sin, and they're so involved in their sin that they're willing to sacrifice the good they could do to other people? How many fathers and mothers fool around with sin and instill a sinful nature in their children? And because they're so in sin, they can't see that they're giving their children a habit of sin, a way to look at life that's sinful. Murder. Jesus said this, going back to the beginning of it. You have heard that it was said by them of old time, you shall not kill, and whosoever shall kill shall be in danger of the judgment. But I say unto you, whosoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whosoever shall say to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whosoever shall say, you fool, shall be in danger of hell fire. Jesus goes back to the beginning, the very, very spark of it. What about lying? Truthfulness. In Acts 5th chapter, verses 1 through 11, we find a man and a woman that sold everything they had, and apparently they decided not to give it all to the Lord, but they were going to say they did. Here's the account. Ananias, with Sapphira, his wife, sold the possession and kept back part of the price. His wife also being privy to it. So they were united in this. They brought a certain part and laid it at the apostles' feet. But Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled your heart to lie to the Holy Ghost and to keep back part of the price of the land? Now, I certainly would hope that this was not because they kept some back for themselves, but because rather that they said that they were giving it all when in fact they weren't. Because look, if the sin was in not giving it all, then everybody in here would better become a defile when it's left and over with. Because we're all hanging on to a part of what we have, aren't we? And we're hanging on to the most of it. We're hanging on, if a pencil and paper was to put to how much that we give to the Lord, it might be shocking at what the percentage actually is that we give to the Lord. Because a person making $40,000, whether you're working or drawing an income, $40,000, 10%, if you just look at 10%, it's $4,000. If you divide that by 52 weeks in a year, that's about $80 a week on a $40,000 income, $80 a week just to get 10%. But it's easy to slip in a 5 or a 10, or even, hey, let that 20 roll. Maybe two 20s roll in the collection plate. But you add it all up, and how close does it come to 10%? Now, I'm not trying to say 10%. I'm just throwing that out there because a lot of people say, give us 10% and you're done. Well, that's easy for a lawyer that's making $300,000 a year. That's pocket change to him. So maybe that's why the Lord didn't say, never laid out exactly what the percentage was we're supposed to give. Anyway, these people came. They came, and apparently they had this lie about what they gave. And how serious was it to tell just a little, to misrepresent ourselves just a little bit? Ananias heard the words of Peter, and he fell down and gave up the ghost. He paid the price. He received his wages right then. The wages of sin are death. 3 hours afterwards, Ananias was cleaned up, taken out. No evidence of what had happened. Sapphira came in. She's got to keep up the lie too. She didn't know what had happened. Peter said, tell me whether you sold the land for so much. And she said, yes, for so much. Then Peter said, how is it that you have agreed together to tempt the Spirit of the Lord? Then she fell down straightway at his feet and yielded up the ghost. They died. They received the wages right then because of the lie that they had concocted. Revelation 21 and 8, this has always sort of scared me because I really thought that there was degrees of these sinful things and lying. Wasn't all that bad, is it? But the fearful and unbelieving and the abominable and murderers and whoremongers and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. What kind of lying are we talking about? The kind that hurt people or the kind that don't hurt people? Well, I don't know. Why would you tell something that was a lie? Why would you tell something you weren't sure was the truth and present it as the truth when it's not? Think you wouldn't get found out? Why do people do it? That's the beginning of the spark of the sin, is to think we've got to be more than we are, to know more than we know, to be more of an expert than we really are, to exaggerate something beyond what actually happened, to embellish, to expand, to amplify what actually happened in an effort to do what? Build us up. Because I can tell you what happened. I know what really happened. Listen to my story. Kind of gets wrapped up in ego, me. It's all about me. Maybe that's where the beginning of all this is. Neglect. This might be a little subtle here. 1 Samuel 2. Now Eli was very old and heard all that his sons did unto all Israel, how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. It's serious. Eli was the priest. His sons were in line to be priests. They lay with the women that came to the door. And he said unto them, why do you do such things? For I hear your evil dealings by all this people. No, my son, for it is no good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people to transgress. Notwithstanding, they hearken not unto the voice of their father, because the Lord would slay them. Neglect. People that neglect to train their children. Proverbs would say in Proverbs 29:15, the rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself brings his mother to shame. We wouldn't think of it, but with children come a grave responsibility to discipline and to correct and to lead in paths of righteousness, to be the example. But, and the Lord just got it backwards, doesn't he? He lets the young people have the kids and the grandparents that live longer that can see the folly, they don't have them. It's not their responsibility. should be backwards, shouldn't it? The older people that know what it means and the value of the discipline and the self-discipline should be the ones. It's not that way. So what does that tell us? That means these kids that are having kids need to take hold, need to have responsibility, need to bear down. The rod and reproof give wisdom. And we're not talking about child abuse here, but we're talking about educational discipline. Unequally yoked. Let's talk about this just a little bit. Is this just a casual thing? 2 Corinthians 6:16 through 18 lays down a principle. This is not the verse you're thinking of, but this lays down the same principle. And what agreement has the temple of God with idols, for you are the temple of the living God, as God has said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be you separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you. And you shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty. That was the same principle that's expressed here. 2 Corinthians 6:14 and 15, be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness? What communion has light with darkness? What concord has Christ with Belial? Or what part has he that believes with an infidel? We've already covered this ground. Most of you were there at Taylor's Crossroads. And to not belabor the point, it's often said that this cannot be applied to marriage. Because so many people have been brought into the church because of a spouse that was in the church. Okay? But I tell you what I hate to see. I hate to see the number of the people that we have lost that were raised up in the church because they married somebody outside the church and were pulled either away from the church altogether or to some other denomination practicing other things. I would hate to see the numbers of the ones that have left us as compared to the ones we've got. Now, thankful for every one that we got, I am. Okay, so if you don't want to say that this applies to marriage, then at least say that it applies to something. I mean, why would a person who wants to live a Christian life seek out a person that was not even conducive to the church, that would not even hear of obeying the gospel? So perhaps when it says, not unequally yoked, may not mean at the same spiritual level of maturity, but do we at least agree that it means people that are sort of headed in the right direction? One's a member of the church, but the other is willing to listen and is a subject to be. But the principle must be observed. And why must it be observed? Because time is short, brother. If we want to be strong and have strong families and raise these children and let these children come from the cradle up to about 6 years of age, when the formative years are there, when that little mind is molded and it's hard to break. Now, some statistics say that by the time a child is 12 years old, that their spirituality is pretty well set, and you won't do much with them after they're 12. But then there's others that say, as far as other attitudes of life, that that's pretty much set at even earlier ages. So we're talking about not waiting until a person's a teenager to do something right, but when they're very young, very young. Now, you've got a spouse that is in the church and one that's not. And one is pulling back hard against the other one. It's going to be hard for the right headway to be made, for the right progress to be made, for that formative years to be good for those children. Time is short. Opportunities are short to make these good impressions. Proverbs 21 and 9, again, this is not my wisdom. This is God speaking through Solomon. Said, it's better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. 10 verses later, he said, it's better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and an angry woman. Now, let's give men their due. It wouldn't be good to be living with a contentious or an angry man either, but the point is, it's better to be off somewhere than with a contentious, angry, brawling spouse. But how did they become that spouse? We picked them. We went out and we looked for a wife or a woman or a man, and we picked them. Nobody made us. We picked them. What went wrong? I don't know. Maybe we didn't pick well. Maybe we didn't handle them well. You know, there's two sides to every story. Two sides to every story. And marriage is such a dynamically linked thing that it's hard to put all the blame on one person, because we affect each other so much. Unequally yoked, 1 Corinthians 7 said, "But I would have you without carefulness. He that is unmarried cares for the things that belong to the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he that is married cares for the things that are of the world, how he may please his wife." There's a difference also between a wife and a virgin. "The unmarried woman cares for the things of the Lord, that she may be holy, both in body and in spirit. But she that is married cares for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I speak for your own profit, not that I may cast a snare upon you, but for that which is comely, and that you may attend upon the Lord without distraction." And there's where I mentioned at the very beginning that sin was a distraction. Anything that takes us away and our attention from the Lord is a distraction. "That you may attend upon the Lord without distraction." The sin is being distracted. The consequences are when we let that distraction run. And have we not seen the grave consequences? Closing observations. Sin is a distraction from serving God. Sin has wages that must be accepted. There is no avoiding. It's going to be death. Not the first death, but the second death. Unavoidable. If we have earned it, we can just take them and say, "Lord, that's my reward. That's the way I live. That's what I deserve." Because the just judge will give us what we deserve. The visible consequences of sin are the result of a failure to connect the heart, as speaking of the heart as the center of emotion, and the brain, the center of intelligent choices. Now, do you think that that's a fair representation of the truth? Our heart and our brain just don't work together. Our brain knows what we ought to do, but our heart leads us to do something else. And we fail to realize how grave the consequences will be when they run out. This is the lesson for the evening. I hope it was interesting to you. And again, I hope that it did not apply to anyone here. We talked about great big sin, but yet in the process we see so many ways, so many little ways that people are affected by these things, that I think we can see how these big things, they'll not stand alone by themselves. Murder does not stand alone by itself, but it has the feelings of anger and all these other things. Covering up the adultery did not stand alone by itself, but it had deceit, betrayal of trust, lying, planning evil and wickedness to take someone's life. See, all these things are tied into the big thing. Let's don't be guilty of even the slightest little thing, so that we don't have to bear these consequences. If anyone is here tonight, subject to the gospel invitation, as always, we stand to help you if we can, either through obedience and conversion to the gospel, being added to the Lord's church, or through the prayers of the church for strengthening and restoration. If we can help, please come while we stand and sing.
God, come and get you. I love you.